is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. President Trump made it clear during the 2016 campaign and since that he has no respect for the way that elected American politicians and governmental employees have conducted domestic and foreign policy in the last 70 years. He promised a new way of doing things, and every day he demonstrates that he's committed to acting on those promises. These radical policy and style changes make his supporters smile and still stir fear and anger in others. It's been a month since political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson have weighed in, but they're here today. Ken, I welcome you back to Cincinnati Edition, and I trust that you have a trivia question to get us started.
I do, Dan, and hi, Dan, and hi, Howard. Okay, the question is, who is the last Republican member of the Senate from Ohio who voted against a Republican president's Supreme Court pick? So you have to name the senator as well as the court nominee.
Whoa.
The last Republican member of the Senate from Ohio who voted against a Republican president's pick for the Supreme Court. And you have to name the name of the senator as well as the name of the nominee for the court.
All right. There. Now, that is a challenge. So if you think you know the answer, call 513-419-7100. And if you have questions on anything else for either Ken or Howard at any time during the show, call that same number, 513-419-7100, or email us at talk@WVXU. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. So we'll see what happens with that trivia question. But let's start today with what's happening right now, because news about national political issues changes literally by the hour. Let's start with what's happening today, and that is that the courts have ordered the administration to reunite children and parents who they separated at the border, and that has to be done by today. Now, the government has admitted that it's going to make great progress in this, but that there's over 900 children who aren't going to be reunited for a variety of reasons. Their parents have already been deported, can't be found, there's criminal records involved. So, Ken, what do you think the ongoing political fallout from this situation is if these reunifications drag on for months?
Well, like with everything, I often say that this time the president has gone too far, the policies have gone too far, and the American people, or even the president's base, will start to rebel, and yet that does not happen. So even in the aftermath of the announcement of all the separation of the children from the parents who were coming here into the country illegally, when the separation of children from the parents started happening, there was a huge outcry, but the Republican Party didn't seem that anguished about it. There were some members of Congress, there was some indication that they could backfire, but it didn't happen. And so when you have things like this, when you have the president talking, saying nice things about Vladimir Putin at the Helsinki news conference, you kind of think, well, this time something is going to really change politically. The president will pay a price. The president party will pay a price. But ultimately, it doesn't happen. And I'm not convinced that even with this tragic story situation about the separation of children from their families, from their parents, there will be a political price to pay.
Howard, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree for the most part, although I think that, you know, with the children, with these, you know, 900 children, sooner or later that's going to hit home, and more, you're going to hear more and more Republicans speaking out about that because they have children too. And it is very difficult for, I mean, that's the thing that here in Ohio, Rob Portman, our Republican senator, was talking about, because he can imagine with his three children, you know, when they were, if they were, had been younger and if they were separated from their parents, you know, what would he feel like? And sooner or later, is this stuff just going to add up, keep adding up and adding up? Now, you had today, you had Jeff Merkley, the Democrat senator from Oregon, was on TV talking about how incompetent and callous the administration is, and you hear a little, you don't hear too many Republicans arguing with him about that. You don't hear them coming out and using those kind of words. So.
Well, you know, I one of the things that I found just incredibly moving this week was Elizabeth Holtzman, a former congressman who had co-authored the Refugee Act of 1980, resigned as an advisor to Homeland Security over this. And besides saying that child kidnapping, that what we have engaged in is child kidnapping, plain and simple, she goes on to say, without creating proper records to enable family reunification shows utter depravity on the part of the government officials involved. I mean, this is, I think the depth
of stuff.
This is, yeah, this is depth of feeling and commitment.
But let's remember who we're quoting here. Jeff Merkley is a liberal Democratic senator from Oregon. Elizabeth Holtzman, when she was in Congress, was one of the most liberal members of Congress. She was in Brooklyn. She was on the House Judiciary Committee during the Nixon impeachment. But we're talking about liberal Republicans. When the Rob Portman starts standing up and the Mitch McConnell starts standing up and saying this is unacceptable, then I think we're going through a political sea change. But until all we're going to have are Republicans sitting and shaking their head and say, boy, this is not so good, and yet not speaking, not coming up and coming forward and speaking up, then nothing changes.
Well, let's move on to something else, and that is last night revealed that 11 House members have signed onto articles of impeachment for Rod Rosenstein, at the assistant director of the Department of Justice. And among those is Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan. What's the likelihood of this going forward in any substantive way? And, you know, is there any political risk to getting this formally out there now?
Well, I don't know if there's any political risk for Mark Meadows, who's the head of the House Freedom Caucus, or Jim Jordan, who announced today his candidacy for House Speaker. I don't know if there's a risk for them. I think they're very well-liked and respected back home. Nationally, first of all, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, said, this is not going to happen. This is not going to happen. Whatever Rod Rosenstein and the Justice Department are accused of, and whether they're not coming forthcoming enough with information, this is hardly high crimes and misdemeanors. It does not call for impeachment, and that's the end of it. I should say that the number three Republican in the House, Steve Scalise, signed on to those 11 Republicans. But for the most part, It's just one of those things where, rather than trying to investigate what the president did vis-a-vis Russia, whether there was collusion, of course, just because Russia tried to meddle or did meddle in the election doesn't mean that the Trump campaign colluded with them. I mean, Trump thinks that every time we talk about Russian meddling, it's collusion. That doesn't necessarily mean that he colluded, but there is an investigation, and that's what Robert Mueller's doing. But if the House Republicans are more interested in silencing the Rod Rosensteins, who, after all, appointed Robert Mueller, then there were shadows of Saturday Night Massacre again. You want to get rid of Rod Rosenstein. You want to get rid of James Comey. You want to get rid of everybody who's investigating the president, and not investigating the president himself, yourself, then, you know, something's kind of rotten.
And this is kind of why Jeff Sessions is saying this is a bad idea.
Yeah. So probably not headed any place. This is just a way of signaling more pressure, though.
And when you talk about Jim Jordan not having any problems back home, he does have a few.
He does. That's a very good point, especially, and it's interesting, too, because the wrestlers who have come forward and talked about, you know, accusations about abuse, and suddenly I had a flashback today of Dennis Hastert, the former Speaker of the House, who also had accusations about wrestlers when they were in high school. So I think it could very well be a bigger scandal than people are mentioning. But right now, it doesn't seem to be affecting his bid for reelection.
By the way, before we get too far away from our first question, we had a caller call in and wants to know if there's anything that can be done if the administration just refuses to obey a court order. I think, in the question of this reunification of families?
Well, I don't think I have an answer to that. I mean, one would think that disobeying a court order is a serious thing, but if the White House continues to say that we can't get it done in time and this is an artificial deadline, I mean, I don't know where we go except unless we go, you know, back to court. But what if, let's just say that the administration says, okay, we agree with the court's decision, but it is physically impossible to unite these families by today's deadline. What do you do? I mean, yeah. I don't know what the answer is.
I think the answer is, you know, you go back to court, you take it all the way up to the Supreme Court.
But then who would the court go after?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I remember during Watergate, there was a question whether or not Richard Nixon would obey the orders of the U.S. Supreme Court, and that if he didn't, there might be a possibility of him, you know, federal agents just walking into the White House and putting him under arrest. But, you know, that was then. This is now.
So I want to get to one more thing before we have to take a break. Yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo testified yesterday afternoon before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Members on both sides of the aisle, and here's a case where I think we are hearing some Republican voices, were really pressing for straightforward answers about what happened in Helsinki between Presidents Trump and Putin. And two things. What do you think of Pompeo's way of handling those questions? And secondly, who was he really concerned about impressing in that testimony? Howard, what do you think?
Well, I think you and I talked about this earlier today, and I think it may well be that he doesn't know the answers to some of those questions about, you know, what was said between Putin and what was said between Trump and Kim in specific promises. And he may not know, but he makes this argument that, you know, the things that a president tells a cabinet member are not to be spoken about in public.
Okay. Ken, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think Pompeo was actually making a losing argument as argumentative and animated as he was. Mm-hmm. First of all, as far as regarding the Republicans who stood up, it was always seemed to be one Republican, the chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, who is retiring this year and doesn't have to worry about getting booed, you know, hissed at by Republican voters back home. But Pompeo basically is making the argument that Donald Trump, you know, is very strong on Russia, very tough on Putin, the sanctions, the expulsions from the country, and he's doing a great job. Whereas, of course, everybody heard what the president had to say in Helsinki at that news conference. It reminds me of the old Marx Brothers line, of course, that, you know, Chico says in one movie to Margaret Dumont, "Who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes?" I mean, we all saw what the president said about Putin, and for Pompeo to say, "Well, the president is really tough, and it's going to be really is really tough on Moscow," it kind of belies what the truth is. But I think, you know, I mean, basically, Pompeo was trying to make the case that this was all politics. He really addressed Bob Menendez, the ranking Democrat on foreign relations, who said that you're asking political gotcha questions. But the point is, we don't know, as Howard said, we don't know what the president said to Putin. There was only a translator in there. What we do seem to know, we're learning more from Moscow journalists than we are from our own. I mean, and then when the president announced, or when the White Administration announced that we would invite Vladimir Putin to the U.S. in the fall, did you see the look on Dan Coats' face, the director of National Intelligence, when he was on a panel with Andrea Mitchell? He, like, his jaw dropped. Yes. He said, you know, say it again? Are you kidding me? So it's clear that, once again, Donald Trump is his own Secretary of State, own Secretary of Defense, own Director of National Intelligence, and many of his own cabinet officials are left in the dark.
I think it's fair to say, though, that invitation has been pulled back.
Mm-hmm. And it has been.
And yes. I think that may be an indication although I don't think the administration ever admit this, that they were taking some real heat for that from Congress. Yes. And did want to pull it back. Businesses, no matter what their size, crave predictability. One of the most problematic aspects of the current trade war is that the strategy is unclear. Will the tariffs be short-term tools to force negotiations and better deals, or will they last long enough that foreign buyers will find other suppliers? And by focusing on farm products and automobiles, doesn't this erode the Trump base going into the midterm elections? To make sense of this and other issues, we are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. And Ken, you must have asked a really tough question because at this point, we have one caller who has called in with a...
this has never happened before.
Yeah, this is really tough. So we're going to go right in. Repeat that question right just before I go to John. Repeat that question so that all of the callers know or all of the listeners know.
Okay, let me ask an easier question then. What are Howard Metzenbaum's initials? No, that's not the question. No, I can't ask an easy question. Okay, this one is...
Just re-ask this question.
Yeah, re-ask this.
Yeah. Okay. The last Republican member of the Senate from Ohio who voted against a Republican president's Supreme Court pick. And the reason I thought of this question is that, you know, there's some talk that maybe Susan Collins of Maine or maybe Lisa Murkowski of Alaska could vote against Brett Kavanaugh, even though it's a Republican president. So okay. I want to know who the last Ohio senator it was to vote against a Republican president's pick.
All right. So... Here we go. We're going to take John's call. John, you have hopefully inside knowledge on this.
Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was thinking it was Senator Saxby and Bork.
Senator Saxby and Bork. Ken?
Well, the reason that can't be the answer is Senator Saxby left the Senate in 1974, and the vote on Bork was in 1987.
Okay. Well, I see people calling in right now, and I think what I'm going to do, rather than going to Howard, who may have an answer, we're going to do some. Let's do some talking here for a minute. Yeah. We'll come back to this and let some other people come in. Thanks for calling, John. On the Pompeo testimony, Howard, you have a point you want to make.
Well, no, just one quick point. The one thing that Pompeo said a quote that jumped out at me was that he said Trump, quote, accepts our intelligence community's conclusion that Russia meddled in the 2016 election. Was that what you heard Trump say in Helsinki?
I didn't. I mean, he does say, I do trust our intelligence, but I also say, as Trump said, but I also heard of Vladimir Putin make a very convincing case against it. So it was almost like a Charlottesville answer. Like, on the one hand, we have this, but on the other hand, I mean, the Charlottesville answers were kind of pretty disgraceful, but I think what we heard in Helsinki wasn't too encouraging either.
Okay. No. Well, fortunately, we have one more caller who, let's see if they don't have the right answer. And Mike, what's your view on your guess on this question?
Senator John W. Brinker and William Brennan.
Ah.
He's going deep. That's a great answer, only because I don't even know if that's the case, and as it could very well be. Bricker was very conservative, and Brennan was an Eisenhower liberal nominee, but I'm looking for somebody more recently than that.
So it was more recent than that one.
All right.
So I think what we have to do we keep taking calls? What do you want me to do? We're going to keep taking calls. That's what I'm told. Let's move on in terms of the discussion here to trade. Yesterday there was, seems like everything was either today or yesterday. I mean, we can't get farther away than that.
Or 5 minutes ago.
There was a meeting with Jean-Claude Juncker of the EU, the president of the EU Commission. And there's coming out of that, there was an indication that both of them, that I think it's fair to say the president's strategies and tactics maybe are working in this area, that, you know, you threaten the maximum punishment and you bring people to the table. Is that how to read this?
I think that's a fair reading, at least of what we saw yesterday. And the reason I say that is because, you know, that the fact that the administration offered up, $12 billion to farmers because they've been really hurt by the tariffs, and they're saying, and the farmers are arguing that what Trump is doing with tariffs are killing the farmers on soybean and corn and things like that. Trump is arguing that don't be impatient. It's a long process, but my strategy will eventually work. And we did see something apparently working yesterday with the head of the EU not only agreeing to lower tariffs, but to agreeing to buy billions of dollars of American soybeans and natural gas and things like that. So if we're looking for winners and losers, I would say that yesterday, at least with the head of the EU, Donald Trump came away as a winner.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's, you know, he may end up being the big winner in this one. But this one's very important, you know, when you're talking about the European Union. This is not...
It's a big market.
It's a very big market. And these are people who have been our allies over the years.
You know, the...
But at the same time, we still have a lot of angry and frustrated farmers who happen to be voters. And we're talking about less than 4 months away from the November elections. And if they don't see results in time, even if it's... And it's interesting, all these Republicans are suddenly saying, well, this bailout, this socialism is a great idea. I mean, this is anathema to everything Republicans always say they stand for. But here they are, the president saying, okay, we're going to have a bailout of farmers, we're going to have subsidies, and all the Republicans say, yeah, it's a great idea, which is, again, exactly what the Republican Party is usually against.
And not quite all of them. I mean, I did hear Portman say that, you know, the farmers back in Ohio, they don't want subsidies. They want markets for their goods.
I think Ben Sasse said that, too.
And Ben Sasse said that, yeah. And that's probably the case. You know, they want markets.
You know, and one of the things about this is, you know, there was agreement yesterday to move forward on negotiating something. But negotiating agreements in the area of trade and tariffs, and Senator Portman really knows this because this was his job at one point, this is difficult. You get down into the weeds and the details, and we're still a long way away from a real agreement with the EU.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. But the fact is that the subsidies, the buyouts, the payments that are going to the farmers now is an acknowledgement that the policy so far has failed and has made a lot of people angry. And so, yes, there are a lot of negotiations to go, and you're absolutely right. Nobody knows this better than Rob Portman, the former trade representative. But having said that, it's a risk. It's a real gamble that Trump has taken on what to do with these rising tariffs, and if he's going to punish the auto manufacturers and the motorcycles in Wisconsin, the Harley Davidsons. Mm-hmm. It's calling somebody's bluff. EU seemed to blink yesterday. The president is obviously hoping others will blink as well.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, too, that the EU soybean market isn't nearly as big as the Chinese soybean market. And this isn't a equal swap here at this particular time. And the other thing on liquid natural gas, we don't have the terminals to actually even do that yet at this point. There's some real infrastructure that has to be built and developed. So, one other question here is... Why do you think the president and Secretary of State Pompeo, obviously in conjunction with each other, ramped up the rhetoric about Iran at this particular moment? you know, what's going on here?
You know the president is angry when he tweets in capital letters. You always know that. I mean, yeah. I have a feeling if Congress were ever to declare war, it would be in capital letters to show that it's serious. Look, there's always been accusations that the president does things to distract from all the problems. And given the Michael Cohen audio tape that basically shows the president not telling the truth about the payments to the Playboy model, given the fact that Paul Manafort is going on trial, given the fact that the blowback to what the president said in Helsinki has still not gone down, there are some people who think that what he did was doing with Iran is a distraction. Now, if you remember, this is exactly what he did with North Korea last year. Little rocket man, we're going to wipe you off the face of the earth. Fire and fury. And it was like World War III was going to be around the corner. And then somehow North Korea and the U.S. got together, Trump and Kim got together, and now they're best buds. So maybe he thinks that by threatening Iran, the same thing could happen.
Same model.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, as soon as I saw the capital letters, I thought immediately of, and this may be cynical, but here he goes, it's another distraction. Make people think about something else than, the really bad stories that have been coming out, the ones that are really potentially harmful to them.
Yeah, and I want
to every time I send in my trivia question, I'm going to do it in capital letters, see what happens.
Yeah.
Because I think more people will stand up and pay attention.
let me we've got a real question, not just a question to not just an answer to the trivia question. Let me get somebody on. Frazier has a question. What, Frazier, are you still there, or did I just ruin that? I think I ruined that. So anyway, I'm now going to take on. Okay, let me get Jim, and let's see if we can't actually get an answer to these questions. So, okay, we're going to do Mark first. I don't know.
Okay. Hello.
Okay, Jim. Do you have an answer?
Well, I have half an answer. I know it's Bork. Do I get half a T-shirt?
It'd be half a button.
Well, I should get half a T-shirt because I know it's Bork, or I think is. Now, what about Voinovich?
Okay, now we've got two. Yeah. Voinovich, Bork.
Voinovich, well, actually, Voinovich was elected to the Senate in 1994, I believe, and the Bork nomination was 1987. So it couldn't have been Voinovich.
All right. So now we've got Mark, I think.
Let's see. Hello.
Mark, are you in line?
Yes, I am.
And what's your answer?
Well, third time's a charm. I had a guess, and then I confirmed it online. John Glenn voted against Robert Bork.
Yes, that's true, but
John Glenn definitely voted against Robert Bork, but I'm looking for a Republican senator again with a Republican presidential nominee. John Glenn is not, of course, not a Republican senator.
Okay, and then we've got Emily. Emily, what's your...
My guess was Voinovich and Alito, but I don't think that's right.
Mm-hmm. Voinovich and Alito.
You know what's fascinating about Alito? As a concern, there was only one Republican senator who voted against Samuel Alito, and that was Chafee of Rhode Island. So, nope, it's not Alito.
It's not Alito. Okay. Now, luckily, Frazier has called back in, and let's see if I can do this right. Frazier, you have a question about substance, not just about the trivia question. So let's get to you.
Excuse me. The trivia question is substantial.
Oh, it's very substantial.
I apologize.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can, sir. Frazier.
Go ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah, so it's kind of in line with the conspiracy theory of the Kim Jong-il make Trump look like a strong man, become his friend at the end kind of a game. Is it possible that what Trump has actually done here, since he's not telling anyone, is that he's actually colluding with our allies to make himself look like the strong man by saying, sitting down to the table with them prior to public knowledge and say, hey, look, we got to do better. You guys come to the table. We'll make an agreement on these tariffs, but let me look like I'm strong-arming you into this. Then that when it becomes public, everybody's like, oh man, Trump's winning, and everything's going his way, his strategy's working, like we're talking about now, right? And then the other people that he has to do business with, our enemies, will feel like, hey, we got to do business with this guy. You know, he is the tough guy on the block.
Ken, what do you think about that?
Well, you know something, there's no questioning his motives, because he takes things very, he always has a very interesting approach to this. But that wouldn't be a bad theory, except for the fact that he seems to delight in tormenting the allies. He will criticize Trudeau, he'll criticize Theresa May, he'll criticize Merkel, but he'll say nice things about Kim and Putin and people like that. So I don't know if that's his ultimate goal, but I do know that I think that if that's his ultimate goal, I don't think that ripping apart our allies and asking questions about the validity of NATO is a smart way of doing it.
Yeah, I just see our allies sitting around the table and say, excuse us, but what's in it for us here?
Yeah, and I think because they take real heat
right
with their own constituents when something like that happens. I doubt if Merkel or May is interested in having to respond to these attacks, and I mean does nothing but hurt them, not help. So I don't know. I think that'd be a hard sell. It'd be a really hard sell. Next week, a number of key things are going to be happening. One, the Paul Manafort trial starts, and the Michael Cohen tape issues are going to nothing but expand. So there's plenty to talk about in the what might happen in the coming week. And to do that, we have political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson, and are with us today for insight. Okay, we have two more callers who have called in. We're going to, I hope, get the answer from either Steve or Mike. So, Stephen, what is your guess?
Is it Voinovich Roberts?
Voinovich Roberts.
It is not. I should tell you that Voinovich has never voted against a Republican president Supreme Court nominee.
Okay. So now we're down to our last caller who has a good guess. So, Mike, what's the answer?
Senator Robert Taft Jr. and Clement Haynsworth.
The problem with that is that Robert Taft was elected to the Senate in 1970, and Clement Haynsworth's vote was in 1969.
Ah, so close, but not. So, Ken, what's the answer to this one? As a teacher, this is a tough one. Go ahead.
Howard, would you like to give a guess?
Yes, I would.
Okay, Howard's had an answer down right from the beginning.
I liked the Haynsworth thing, but I said Bill Saxby, Senator, and Harold Carswell.
Well, you get Howard gets half a T-shirt because it is William Saxby,
but
Saxby voted against Haynsworth, not against
Haynsworth.
Carswell.
Okay, see, that's what I was going back and forth. Was it Haynsworth or was it Carswell that he voted against?
This is remarkable. 17 Republicans. This is Richard Nixon's nominee of Clement Haynsworth in 1969. 17 Republicans voted against him, including the Republican leader Hugh Scott, the Republican Whip Bob Griffin. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. 17 Republicans, whereas Clarence Thomas, who was so controversial, only 2 Republicans voted against him. But it's Saxby and Haynsworth. So Howard gets half a T-shirt with that.
Wow.
Yeah. So
which half?
Maybe it'll be just one sleeve. Just one sleeve.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. As I was mentioning at the this coming week, the trial of Paul Manafort gets started. There's a lot hanging on this for Paul Manafort, certainly, but also for the president. Ken, what do you see as the possibilities that at the last minute Manafort might flip and decide to cooperate, knowing what he's facing?
Well, that's a great question. And the reason it's a great question is because of all the people who've either been indicted or, you know, or under suspicion by the Justice Department, by Robert Mueller, Manafort has refused to cooperate from the beginning. Now, he's on trial for tax evasion and some kind of conspiracy trial, but it doesn't seem, I'm not exactly convinced it's part of what he did when he was working for Donald Trump. I mean, he does have his clients. He does. He has lied to authorities, but I don't know how much it really implicates Donald Trump, even though he was Donald Trump's campaign manager. He's also going to go on trial in September for what he did with Ukraine and the pro-Russian heads of Ukraine back then. That may be more of a consequential trial, but I don't know. I know there are people willing to and ready to testify against Manafort, and of course Donald Trump has always hinted that, you know, whatever happens to Manafort, he can pardon him, and the president certainly has the right to pardon him if he wants to. So right now my guess is that he just stays quiet and takes his chances and hopes for a pardon. If he's guilty, and I'm not supposing I'm not presupposing that he is.
Let's say there was a pardon. If there were a pardon, Mueller could call him back in a trial, and he'd lose his Fifth Amendment.
He could call him before a grand jury, I think,
right.
Couldn't he? And
exactly.
He can't plead Fifth Amendment anymore.
Fifth Amendment.
So I think it's kind of
that
tricky.
Would be a big risk, I would think, for him. You know, depending on what he knows and what he.
And remember, Rick Gates, his top aide, has already agreed to cooperate. So mm-hmm. I assume Rick Gates is one of the people who will testify against him. It is a high risk act for Manafort. You know, and remember, back in the old days, Manafort's partner in that firm, the Republican firm, was a guy named Roger Stone. So they're all somehow connected in some ways, and they're a tremendous risk for Manafort. I my gut tells me that if anything, if President Trump is watching anything most carefully and closely, it's the Michael Cohen story.
Mm-hmm. So, and how important do you think this tape was that was released this week of Michael Cohen and the president talking about a payoff? How important is that tape in itself?
I think it's huge. And the reason I think it's huge is because even though the president says, I can't believe a lawyer would tape his client, it's probably criminal. The fact is that the tape shows that the president has been lying. I hate to say that word. I mean, there's so many words I've heard in the past couple of weeks. Treason, traitors. I mean, those are words that you see in Manchurian Candidate or something out of Joe McCarthy's era, but it's just scary the kind of words using up. So for me to say the word lying is just, my fist clenched because I think it's a scary word to say. But the fact is that the president all along is saying, I know nothing about this. I never heard of Karen McDougal. I had no affair with her. I never discussed anything like that. And here we have him on a tape with Michael Cohen say about the money that would go to the National Enquirer or whatever, and how do we pay it and things like that. So the president did know about it, even though he and Hope Hicks and others in the administration insist that he knows nothing about it.
And
it shows that he was not telling the truth.
And he knew exactly how much money they were going to pay her.
So
$150,000.
Right.
I'm wondering if the question here is not that there's this tape and all of the things you've just pointed out, but this indicates, and from what we think we know, there's a whole bunch of other tapes, and who knows what's on those?
Well, I read somewhere that this is really the only tape that really implicates Trump. But the fact is that being his longtime fixer, Michael Cohen knows where the bodies are buried. And I always thought it was a strange strategy for the president to basically criticize Cohen or dismiss him as important. You know, the way he said about Manafort, well, he was only, you know, my campaign manager for 15 minutes. He said similar things about Michael Cohen that, well, I don't really think he knows that much or he was not that important. Michael Cohen, from everything I've read, is so desperate for the affection and the confidence of Donald Trump. And if he feels spurned, as he apparently does, he could be willing to unload a ton of information. And if I were Donald Trump, I would be very scared about that.
And he's got a pretty good lawyer, too. And Lanny Davis.
Isn't that something? Lanny Davis, well, who defended Bill and Hillary Clinton to the hilt, and here he is defending Michael Cohen. Well, yeah. Strange things.
It's strange, but yeah.
So what is Lanny Davis? What is his – who is this person? What's his relationship to the Clinton organization circle?
Well, it's a very close relationship ever since the beginning. I mean, he's one of the, you know, one of their people. He just wrote a book or just published a book about the election of 2016 and how it was James Comey who cost Hillary Clinton the presidency. He's very close to them. He's
so
always been inner circle of the Clintons.
So why do you think Michael Cohen would have gone out and gotten him as the lawyer?
Well, yeah, apparently he was available, Dan.
Yeah. Who's paying Michael Cohen's bills at this point?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Because there's got to be huge legal costs involved here.
Absolutely.
And whatever.
I mean, Michael Cohen was well paid by Trump. I don't know how much money he does have. There is stories about him buying expensive apartments or having a lot of money to open up businesses. So, I mean, I'm sure the legal bills are going to be a fortune. And but I assume that he's been well compensated by the Trump organization after all these years. You know, I know we're running out of time, but there's a special election coming up August 7th in Columbus that I think that we should talk about a little bit, because just like with the Conor Lamb election in Pennsylvania a few months ago, this is a long time, historically long time, Republican House seat, the one currently held, was recently held by Pat Tiberi. Before that, it was John Kasich. Long time Republican seat that the Democrats really have a shot of winning. And I think it's one of those elections where people will be watching and to see if the Democrats win it, will it portend some kind of good news for the Democrats, bad news for the Republicans in November?
Howard, what's the background on this particular race, and where do you think we stand on it?
Well, right now, I mean, people are calling it a toss-up. You know, Sabato's crystal ball came out the other day and switched it over from Lean's Republican to a toss-up. And the Republicans are quite clearly concerned. They're pouring millions of dollars into that district to beat up Danny O'Connor. Danny O'Connor kind of made a odd step in that first he came out and he said he wouldn't vote for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker if he were elected.
This is the Democratic nominee.
Democratic candidate, which is the same thing that Conor Lamb did in Pennsylvania. But then something happened. There must have been some conversations, and suddenly he's back supporting Pelosi for Speaker.
Well, I think what he said was, "I'll vote for the Democratic leader or something."
But look, this is not how the Republicans are casting it.
The commercials are all about Nancy Pelosi. That's correct. And look, this is a seat. I mean, this is fascinating to me. But the Democrats won it for one term in 1980. Before that, the last time they won it was 1936. And matter of fact, the last time the district voted a Democrat for president was Woodrow Wilson in 1916. Let's just say this is a Republican district through and through. John Kasich, Pat Tiberi, Sam Devine, if those of you who remember from the 70s and 80s.
Right.
But you know, you just got to see where the Republicans have weaknesses and where the Democrats have strength. Obviously, Danny O'Connor can't run to the left. He can't embrace Nancy Pelosi, but at the same time, he's got to get every Democrat he can. He can't let progressive Democrats sit home. He has to show them that he's a big tent Democrat if the Democrats going to have a shot at winning. But right now, it looks very, very close. The election's August 7th.
I know this district very well. I've been in all the towns, all the counties.
And where is it in relationship?
Well, it's central Ohio. It sort of comes up out of the northwest of or northeast of Columbus, and takes in a number of these smaller counties, like in places like Mount Vernon, and it's small town America. It's not extremist, but it's moderate mainstream Republicans, but it's almost impossible to imagine them electing a Democrat to Congress, but it could well happen here. And if it does,
during the primary,
it is really going to have a big impact.
Ken?
I was going to say, during the primary, a far-right candidate almost won the nomination. So even though it has a history of electing moderate conservative Republicans in the past, a far-right Republican barely lost the primary. So I don't know how united the Republican Party is. If they make it about Nancy Pelosi and against the far-left Danny O'Connor, then maybe the Republicans can get their act together. But in the primary, they did not look united, and I know we always make bigger deals of these special elections than they deserve to be, but sometimes they do send a signal. And again, if a Democrat won this seat on August 7th, I think it'll send shockwaves and another wake-up call for the Republicans for November.
We are running out of time, but there is a something I want to raise, and that is an incident at the White House yesterday with a CNN reporter, Caitlin Collins, who was banned from an open press event because the White House was unhappy with questions she had asked earlier in the day. How unusual is this for this to happen, Howard?
Well, it's very unusual. It just doesn't happen. A credentialed correspondent of a major news organization is shut out at the doors and no, you can't come in. I don't care what kind of credentials, you cannot come in because of the questions that you were asking earlier.
And she was asking questions about whether President Trump was worried about the Cohen situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Ken, what do you think about that particular case? Does it show just how nervous the White House is?
I don't think they're nervous. I think they're just angry. I think they're just so dismissive of reporters. Now, Kellyanne Conway talked about this today, and she said, well, this woman was kind of disrespectful, and she was asked, they had their chance to ask questions earlier, but when the time she was yelling out the questions, it was too late, and she was disrespectful. But this is what bugs me the most, is that in a recent event, there was a recent appearance where Jim Acosta of CNN stood up, asked a question. The president would not recognize him. He said, CNN is fake news. I am not going to take a question from fake news. And then he went to John Roberts of Fox News. If I were a reporter there, and who knows what I would have done, but my gut tells me I would have walked out. I think the entire press corps should have stood up and said, we are all in this together.
Right.
And to single out CNN or NBC as unworthy of getting questions of the president is beyond a lack of respect, it's just a scary moment for the freedom of the press.
Well, I want to thank Ken Rutan and Howard Wilkinson for being here today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are at WVXU.org. I'm Dan Hurley.